morning. So last time, we talked more about Synesis, sheet of caches, and we dealt with some details we hadn't really encountered, dealing with sort of simply, how do we look up something in a cache, check if it's there. So one of these was, well, when we're placing something new in the cache, sometimes there's not an empty space for it. And in that case, we need to decide where to put it. And in a direct comp cache, well, it was simple. We had one place it was allowed to go. In a associative cache, we have a bunch of places it's allowed to go, and we need to choose one of them. And the way we make this choice is called a replacement policy. And there's a bunch of options. So maybe the best option from a sort of, if we can make any choice, what would be the best choice to make is least recently used, because we assumed when we were building our caches, we had this idea of locality. And if we want to take advantage of that, we want to say, well, the most likely things to be used again are things which were used recently, therefore the least likely things to be used again are things which were used least recently. And this is something we can implement, but it turns out that it's a bit tricky. So one thing that's tricky about it is that just tracking what's least recently used requires us to actually track kind of the order of all our ways. And if we have two ways, well, that's pretty simple. If we have 8 or 16, that can get pretty complicated. You know, that makes updating that list a lot of work. So what we'll commonly see processors do in practice when they have much more than two ways is they'll say, well, it isn't really worth implementing an actual least recently used policy, but I'm going to do something like it. So I'll do some sort of approximation of recently used, where the bookkeeping is simpler. And usually that will do about as well, because we don't really care about having the exactness of like choosing the least recently used thing of our choices. We just want to avoid choosing a more recently used thing, because the notion of locality that we're starting with is kind of an approximation anyway. So we know programs tend to follow this sort of temporal and spatial locality pattern, but it's not like they, you know, that predicts their behavior exactly. That's an approximation anyways. So we're not going to really be paid off by doing least recently used exactly anyways. So we might as well do some faster approximation. Now, some processor designers and cache designers say, well, least recently used, yeah, we could do an approximation. Those are relatively simple implement. But kind of a fundamental property of doing least recently used is that we're kind of paying attention to our reads to the cache and doing some bookkeeping based on those reads. And this means that kind of every time we're just reading from the cache, because of that bookkeeping, that's turning also into a write. That's kind of inconvenient, and we might want to avoid that. And some processor designers have said, yeah, that's too much work. I don't want to actually write bookkeeping information every time we're doing an access. So I'm going to choose some sort of replacement policy where I don't need to keep track of things when we're doing reads. And one idea we can have for this is called first in, first out. So the way this policy works out is that in each set, we replace way 0, then 1, 2, 3, until we run out, and then we go back to 0. So in this case, at least we're replacing something that we haven't brought in recently, so it's likely to be less recently used. But we aren't tracking reads, so we don't actually know that. Could be wrong. But we aren't doing bookkeeping on every read, so that should like help us in that sense. And sometimes they might say, well, I don't want to do any extra bookkeeping. And you can implement a policy where you just choose randomly. And it turns out that does kind of okay. So some processors have done that. Then we talked a bit about handling writes. So when we introduced caches, we were just talking about doing reads. But programs write things to memory too. We kind of need to make that work. And there's two big decisions we need to make when we're deciding how our caches handle writes. So one is, if I look at a write that the processor is giving me, and I look that up in my cache, and I find out it's not there, what do I do? And we could say, well, you're writing this value. That probably means you're going to use it soon. Let's bring it into the cache, just like you would with a read. And this policy is called write allocate. But not all caches do that. Some do the opposite policy of write no allocate, where they'll say, if it's not in the cache already, let's not bother putting it in on a write. that's too much work, and maybe I don't really believe that you're likely to access it again soon as much as I do as if you were reading it. Now, when we have a value that is stored in the cache, so we do a write, we look it up, and it is there, or we put it there, we have another decision to make, which is about when we apply the write to the next level. So we're always, always going to write to the cache, because it would be really bad if you wrote something and then read back the old version. We never want that to happen. So if we have the value cache, we're always going to write it. But there's a question of when do we send the new version to the next level? We don't actually have to do it right away, because if you read it back, you'll read the version from the cache. And we know the next level is slow, so we'd like to avoid writing things to it all the time. So one idea we might have is called write back, but we won't write it right away. We'll save it for later. The opposite of this is write through, where we always write it right away. I'd say, why would we want to do this write through idea? Well, the problem is that if we don't write it right away, we have to send it eventually. So we have to remember to send it. Right, say, okay, well, let's just write something every time we replace a value. If we did that, then we'd be writing things that were only read all the time, and that would be a lot slower. So what we'll do instead is we'll track which values have been modified, but we haven't written yet to the next level, if we're doing this write back idea. We track that with what we call a dirty bit. So if we have this write back policy, we're not going to send it to the next level until we absolutely need to, but we need to remember that we want to do that. So it's not the case that you write a value, you don't access it for a while, it gets evicted, and then you read it back and you read back the old version. You never want that to happen. So we need to have something to remember. This is an updated version that needs to go to the next level at some point. For write back, or we could have write through where we say, I'm just always going to write to the next level right away. In that case, I don't need to remember anything because I just handle it immediately on the write. Problem is that might be slower, especially if we have multiple writes replacing the same value. Each of them is going to go to the next level, even if that might not otherwise be needed. Then we started talking about average memory access time. So average memory access time was sort of a way where we're going to start evaluating, now, how do I compare to cache designs? And what we really care about is how fast they appear to the program. So average memory access time is sort of our measure of how fast is a memory access for a program you're running. And the formula I gave was this hit time plus miss rate times miss penalty. And miss penalty is the extra time on a miss. So it's the miss time minus the hit time. Another way we could phrase this, just with algebra, so this is the same as the hit time times the hit rate plus the miss time times the miss rate. And you can find that these are equivalent if you do the algebra using our definition of miss penalty based on miss time and miss hit time. And the reason that this is going to be a convenient way to think about sort of cache performance is one thing we can kind of like say, you know, what will changing my hit rate or my miss time do sort of greatly. Another is that different changes we make to the cache will affect different parts of this formula. And we can think about, you know, what part of the formula needs the most improvement and decide on what cache changes to try based on that. So questions about these things we covered last time? So I'll probably talk a little about things on the quiz. So start with quiz question one. So in quiz question one, we were asked where a particular byte of the cache came from. And in the cache, we saw we had, we had our data bytes, which was 0F, 1C, dot, 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 and this was six other bytes. And we were asked where this 1C came from. So since we had 8 bytes in this block that was written out, you could tell that there were 3 offset bits. So 8 bytes here. That is 8 bytes in total. And this was the second byte. So the first one was 000, second one was 001. So this was offset 1. And also in the cache, we had our sets. We had set 0, set 1, this was set 1. And we had a total of 4 sets. So we had 4 sets total. That's 2 set index bits. This was set 1. That's 0, 1 is the set index that we would have for that. And we also had our tag. And the way we construct our addresses is that it's tag, then index, then offset. So we have our offset, our index, and our tag. We put those together, we get the address that this came from. So questions about constructing this address? Then we'll talk about question 3, which was probably the confusion. So question 3, we had a write no allocate write through cache. So because of write no allocate, writes didn't affect what's in this cache. Like other caches they might, but this is a write no allocate cache. So we wouldn't add things to the cache because of a write. And because of write through, the writes always go to the next level of the cache. So we had 40 writes that we described. We said we were accessing the array A, writing to it 10 times in total, 1 byte at a time. There were 4 bytes in the array, so that's 40 writes that are going to happen regardless of whether those are hits or misses. Because we're asking what happens, what goes to the next level. 40 writes go to the next level, even if they also get modify things in the cache. So let me think about the reads. Now to think about the reads, we need to understand how did our array map to the cache? And we had this 4-byte array and 2-byte blocks. And there's some information I neglected to give you that most of you assumed the simple version, which is that, let's say the array A starts at an even address. Our blocks, because they're 2 bytes, always start at an even address. They always have an even byte and an odd byte. So in that case, A0 and A1, the 2 bytes of the array A, would be together in a block, and A2 and A3 would be together in a block. And we had a 2-set cache, and let's say things worked out that the first block, A0 and A1, map to set 0, then A2 and A3 would have to be set 1 because it's just the next thing in memory. If they map to set 1, the next one would be 0 because it wraps around. So in either case, these two parts of the array would be two different blocks and they'd be in different sets. So we don't have to worry about them conflicting. We can actually store both of them at the same time in this 2-set direct map cache. If A is in an odd address, things get ugly. So if A is in an odd address, then the block which contains A0 also contains the byte before, because it starts at an even address. And the block that contains A3, which is also an even address, because we started in which is an even address because we started in an odd address, added an odd number, also contains the byte after the array. And it turns out that this first block and this last block are going to be in the same set. That because the middle one's in a different set, the first and last are in the same set, so they're going to conflict with each other. We can't actually store both at the same time. Which will be a problem we'll see later. So let's start with our even address case. So what happens for reads to A is first we read an A0, that's a miss. We're going to have to do a read to the next level to get the value, but we're going to store it in the cache. Then we're going to read A1, try to read A1, that's a hit. Read an A2, that's gonna bring an A2 and A3, that's gonna be a miss, it's gonna go to the next level. Then everything else is gonna be hits, which we're gonna satisfy without contacting the next level. So we have two reads to the next level, total. For the accesses to A. So that's nice and simple. So questions on their accesses to A. Now, if A started at an out address, things get ugly. We have our read of A0, which brings in also that byte before, just because it happens to be in the same block. We have a read of A1 and A2. And A1 and A2, that's gonna be fine. We're gonna keep those in their cache because we're not gonna access anything else that maps to the same set while we're dealing with array A. But then we access A3, and that's going to remove A1 and A0. And then we access A0, and that's gonna remove A3, and we kind of have this value ping-ponging between storing 0 and 3, 0 and 3, so we have two extra reads every time you scan through the array. We do keep the middle of the array in the cache, but not the ends. So overall, this gives us, we have our 40 writes, no matter what we're doing. We always have 40 writes going to the next level. If A starts at an even address, we have two reads of A, and we also write B at a different array B at the end. If B also starts at an even address, we have two reads for that. But then we have some other cases where we have, Then we have other cases if A is in an odd address, or if B is in an odd address, we have an extra read for a 4-byte array B, which will be split, could be split across two or three blocks, depending on whether it starts in the even address. So questions? I figured this out. And so these were the possible answers. We accepted any of them. Most people just said, oh, the array starts at the beginning of a cache block, because that's a good thing to do. And indeed, it turns out that that is what compilers and like malloc implementations will try to do in practice. Because, well, it's slower, it's more misses if you don't do that. Okay, so that's quiz question 3. Okay, so quiz question 4 was asking how many tag bits we had, and we had a 4 megabyte 4-way 64-byte block cache. So this is a 4-megabyte cache, 64-byte block. 64-byte blocks means we have 6 offset bits, because 64 is 2 to the 6. We have 4 megabytes, and remember, the size of the cache is the data size. It doesn't include any of the metadata, none of the valid bits, it's just the data size. So we have 2 to the 22 bytes of data, and each set contains 4 ways, which has 64, and each of those 4 ways in the set has 64 bytes of data. So we can use the data size and that to figure out there's 2 to the 14 sets, or 14 set index bits. And we had 64-bit addresses, so we had 44 tag bits per block. And the number of blocks, when we compute that, is we have 2 to the 14 sets, we have 4 ways, so 4 blocks per set. So we had 2 to the 16 blocks. Each of those 2 to the 16 blocks has a tag stored alongside it. So we have 44 times that is the number of tag bits. So it ends up we have, you know, almost 3 megabits, which is, you know, hundreds of kilobytes of tags stored in this cache. So questions? Computation. Okay, then we have the final question, sort of looking at an access pattern in this cache. And the way I evaluated this is I first I figured out for each of the things being accessed what the set and tag was, the set index and the tag was. And we were asked to count valid and dirty bits. So we started out with no valid and dirty bits, the cache was empty. And then I have a write. And this is a write allocate cache. So on the write, we're gonna bring it into the cache. So we have an extra valid bit because it wasn't in the cache before. I know it wasn't in the cache before because nothing else accessed anything. And we're writing, and it's a write back cache, so we're not gonna immediately go to the next level. Instead, we're gonna mark it as dirty because of our write back policy, it's not write through. Then I wrote to a different thing with the same set and tag. That's gonna be already in the cache because I already accessed that same set and tag. And I already wrote to it, so I don't need to mark it as dirty, it's already marked as dirty, so there's no change to the number of valid or dirty bits. Then I have a read. Again, I'm reading the same set and tag, it's already in the cache, it's already valid, I don't need to change, I'm not gonna change anything, same number of valid or dirty bits. Then I read two things from new sets. I'm gonna read them into the cache, that's gonna add a valid bit, I'm gonna store them in the sets that they map to. Then I have a write. This is a write to a new set, so I don't have to worry about it conflicting with anything, but because it's a write and we have a write allocate cache, we're gonna add a valid bit, because it's a write back cache, we're gonna add a dirty bit because we're gonna store it in the cache, we're not going to the next level right away. Then I have a read that maps to the same set, but it's a different tag, so it has to be stored in the same set as something else. Now, if this was a direct map cache, this would mean that this read would replace this write and we'd write something back to memory to deal with the dirty bits. But it's a four-way cache. And we have plenty of space left over in the set to store this somewhere it doesn't conflict, and that's what we're gonna do. So we're just gonna have an extra valid bit. We aren't gonna have to write anything back, even though you have two things mapping to the same set. We still have options. And I count up what happens above, and I get 5 valid bits and 2 dirty bits. Questions? Get that analysis. Yeah. Question for the second write, the change to dirty bit is already dirty? Yeah. Another way you can think of it is the write sets the dirty bit to 1, but it was already set to 1. So it doesn't change anything. Answer your question. Other questions? Yeah. Question, would all the ones with the 44 tags be in the same block? No. So remember that the blocks are 64 bytes. So one way we could figure out that that's not gonna be the case is that if I take this and add 64, that's definitely not in the range of this, right? It's way off. So the tag, remember, disambiguates given that we know the set. And these are all in different sets. But the ones addresses in the beginning are all in different sets because they're far apart. Another way of thinking about it is that if we like took the block number, right, that this address is 20 hex blocks away from this address. Now it happens that doesn't perform any of the tag because I count for those blocks in the set index rather than the tag. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So last time when we finished up, we were talking about average memory access time. We did this example of doing an average memory access time calculation to figure out, oh, how much do we need to improve the hit rate to sort of match our prior sort of overall memory access time. Because generally when we're sort of doing things with caches, we're going to be kind of balancing between, you know, things that improve our hit time, or things that improve our miss rate but hurt our hit time, and things like that. We want to know, like, sort of, when is that trade-off worthwhile? So another thing that the average memory access time formula is kind of useful for getting an idea about is why we have multi-level caches. As one thing I say is, well, couldn't you just have a level one cache that's better using the space we're using to build our level two cache? And looking at sort of how having a second level of cache affects our average memory access time gives us an idea of sort of why the design decision of having multiple levels in the hierarchy sort of has become sort of the de facto processor setup. So here we have an example. Let's say we have an L1 cache with a 3-cycle hit time and a 90% hit rate. And instead of going to main memory after that, we go to a level 2 cache. This level 2 cache is a lot slower, so it has a 10-cycle hit time and it has an 80% hit rate. You may say, wait a moment. This L2 cache has a much worse hit rate than the L1. So when we're measuring the hit rate of a level 2 cache, generally we're measuring the rate of accesses which get there. And the level 1 cache typically has handled all the easy accesses. So all the things which are easy to make hits have been handled by the level 1. So the sort of accesses that are making it to the level 2 are much harder. They have less good locality. So generally, you'll see in practice, level 2 and level 3 caches will have often lower hit rates than the level 1. Because the level 1's kind of filtered out all the easy accesses, and we only have hard ones. So let's assume of the accesses which make it to the level 2, 80% of them are hits. And we also have a main memory, which takes 100 seconds. And let's assume, for this question, that we're not going to go to the level 2 until after we finish with the level 1. And that finishing with the level 1 is going to take the whole hit time. So when we have an access that misses in the L1 and hits the L2, what we're going to do is we're first going to take 3 cycles to see if it's in the L1. And only then are we going to start contacting the L2. And then we're going to take 10 cycles to get the value if it's in the L2. And if we're going all the way to main memory, we're going to wait until the L2 doesn't have anything before we go to the next one. So this is roughly, the simplest way of implementing these caches. So in practice, you might do something that's like maybe not so bad. So maybe, for example, you could figure out that you're going to have a miss in less than 3 cycles on the L1, even though it might take 3 cycles to get the data out. So some caches work that way, some don't. Well, let's assume that in this case, we have to do the whole access before we realize whether it's a hit or a miss. And that means we don't go to the L2. The question is, what's our average memory access time for the L1? And we're going to see that there's a big effect of having this level 2 cache, even though it has not a great hit rate. like some more time? Okay, so anyone want to volunteer and answer? Yeah. 5.5, how did you get that?
3 times 90%.
3 times 90%. So this is 90% of the time it takes 3 cycles. 8% times 10, so what's this 10? So the hit time for the L2. Okay, so this is assuming that we can, when we have access, we go to the L2 right away. But that's unfortunate, that's not the design we're assuming. So indeed, that's something that might be nice to try to do, but probably that would overload the L2. So we probably can't like send every access to the L2 right away. We can, so we're assuming in this question that we'd have to wait the full 3 cycles to do that. It would be a good optimization, and some processors will try to like do it a little earlier, but usually it will take a little bit of time. Okay. So, and then you had a 2% case, which was 113 for the 2%. Okay. So if we do it with the numbers where we take into account that when we go to the L2, we have to first miss in the L1, and that takes time. When we go to main memory, we first have to miss in the L1 and the L2, and that takes time because we're not just going to go to memory right away. We're going to wait. We should get 6 cycles. And this 5.5 tells us that, well, that's how potentially faster we could be if we could somehow figure out that we have misses earlier, which some designs actually will do. Okay, so we take 6 cycles for that. I have that written down, computed in a different way. So use the hit time times hit rate plus miss time times miss rate formula. Another way we can compute this is I can say hit time plus miss rate times the miss penalty. And it turns out that miss penalty is a little more convenient in this question because the miss penalty is just the extra time on a miss. And the extra time on a miss is only the access for the L2 because we've already done the hit attempt for the L1. And the same when we get to main. But we get 6 cycles here. And if we compare this to what would happen if we just had 1 level of cache, you know, if we didn't have the L2, well, if we didn't have the L2, this would be 3 plus 10% of the time we take an extra 100 cycles, which would be, you know, 13 cycles out L2, and it turns out that you can make the L1 cache a lot better and still be performing worse than adding this L2 cache. Like if we increase the hit rate to 95%, we'd still be worse by a lot. And increasing the hit rate to 95% is actually a big change because that's halving the number of misses. So you can see here, like this might give you an intuition for why did all the processor designers settle on having multiple levels of cache? It turns out it helps a whole lot, even though that second level is a lot slower than our L1. And even when that second level doesn't have an amazing hit rate, which often it does not, relative to the sort of 90%+ hit rates you often see for level 1 caches. And as I mentioned, one of the other things this formula was useful for is thinking about sort of what changes to make to your cache. We can kind of look at all our cache design decisions and figure out where do they change this formula. So in this chart, I'm assuming that except when I'm talking about cache size, that we keep the total size of the cache roughly the same. So this means that if we're increasing the associativity, well, the way we do that is by decreasing the number of sets and adding weights to keep the size the same as we're doing that. And if we're increasing the block size, the way I'm doing that is by decreasing the number of sets to have bigger blocks. So sort of making each set wide to keep the cache size the same. So if we increase the cache size, we don't keep it the same, we expect our miss rate should be better. That will have less, more hits, but our hit time gets worse. If we increase the sensitivity, our miss rate usually gets better because we have less conflicts, we have less cases where two things accidentally map to the same set. Our hit time gets worse because now we have to check more tags on a hit. And our miss penalty might get worse because the replacement is more complicated. It's a question mark. It probably isn't a big effect. If we increase the block size, the effect on miss rate actually is a bit variable. So if we make our blocks really, really small, we're not taking advantage of spatial locality anymore. If we make our blocks really, really big, then if we keep the cache size the same, we just have less sets, less places to store things. We can store less distinct values. So we'll end up having, usually for most programs, we'll end up having more misses because, you know, we'll just not be able to store as much stuff, like as many variables, because not everything's going to be together in a block. We'll just have lots of, we'll have these big blocks and we won't be using all of most of those blocks, and that will be wasted space, basically. And so sort of empirically, sort of the block size, you know, kind of gives us some sort of curve like this as far as miss rates. And if we increase the block size, our hit time becomes worse. Why does it become worse? Because we have a bigger block to scan through to find the part we care about. So usually our hit time will become worse, maybe not entirely because we have fewer sets. And our miss penalty becomes worse because we have to bring in more stuff on a miss. You have to read more from the next level. If we add a secondary cache, we learn that makes our miss penalty better. So that's a way of improving the miss penalty. And we can kind of do the same kind of analysis for various other cache changes and think about where in the formula does it change things. Questions about this sort of view, thinking about average memory access time and cache changes. So another thing we might do is we might say, well, if I want to look at changing my cache, you know, some things are going to help programs and some aren't, as far as like, because programs do access the cache in different ways. And it's helpful to think about, you know, why is the cache having bad performance for a particular program? And we can look at the overall miss rate, but we really want to like look at that miss rate and divide it into sort of what's causing each of the parts. And a common way people designing caches will try to categorize misses is these three categories. And generally what they'll do is they'll assume they've chosen a block size and that block size is fixed, and then they'll categorize the misses as either compulsory, also known as cold. So these are cases where it's the first time we're accessing a block. This is called compulsory miss because, well, we haven't accessed it before. How could we have possibly avoided that? You know, we had to read it in the first time. We also have conflict misses. And this is a miss where we had enough space in our cache, but we didn't use that space intelligently. So like we had two things that mapped to the same set, and we ran out of room in that set, and that was our problem. But other sets had space. We could have, if we were smarter about allocating our blocks to the data being accessed, we wouldn't have had a problem. One way of thinking about this is, let's say we made the cache fully associative, where we had everything in one big set, we would have done better with a conflict miss. We would have avoided that conflict miss by just having more options. And the third category is a capacity miss. This is where, you know, even if we had that full flexibility in order to put things in the cache, we just have too much stuff. We just can't avoid that miss because there's just too much stuff to store. We ran out of space. You know, we have to get rid of something. So we had to have some misses. So we can kind of mechanically categorize things in this way. And this is useful because it lets us know, well, what sort of changes to our cache should we make? So for example, if almost all of our misses are compulsory misses, well, fiddling with the associativity, probably not a good idea. Not going to really do much. if most of our misses are conflict misses, then you'd want to fiddle with the associativity, probably. Like, that's a good thing. If most of them are capacity misses, then it doesn't, you shouldn't really be playing with, let's add more ways. That's not going to solve any of your problems. So this is a very useful analysis to do. Now, you might say, wait a moment, this compulsoriness idea, that seems like a problem. Like, so we find we have a bunch of compulsory misses, we can't do anything about it, right? Well, turns out there are things we can do. So one thing to note is that this is assuming the block size is fixed. If we make the blocks bigger, that will often decrease the number of compulsory misses, because every time we have a miss, we'll bring in more stuff. And sometimes, some of that, the rest of the block that we bring in, the bigger blocks we're bringing in means that more of that stuff we're bringing in is used. There's another thing we can do, that is commonly done, called prefetching, which can deal with compulsory misses. And this is kind of challenging the assumption that we have to have a miss to read something into the cache. So here, instead, we're going to say, let's try to read things into our cache before there's a miss. Let's just read the value in before the program actually tries to access it. And this seems like a good idea, except that you have to figure out, how do we figure out what the program wants to access before it accesses it? We can't do that. And yes, we can't actually figure that out in general, but we can make guesses. And it turns out that making guesses is easy, at least sometimes. So let's say, for example, we see the program is accessing address 48010, then 48020, then 48030, then 48040. You can probably guess what the next thing block the program is going to access is. And it's fairly easy to make that guess. And this sort of pattern is actually very common. So if we think of instruction fetches, very common. Right? They typically have this sort of pattern. Like, sometimes, yes, we won't actually go to 050 because, like, we have a loop. But very commonly, we'll go to 050. It's a great guess. We have an array. You know, very commonly, we'll go to 050. Sometimes we might not. Maybe we got to the end of the array. But it's so commonly right. And this sort of pattern is very common and something that we can look for with a little bit of hardware. We can have hardware checking for patterns like this. And when we see a pattern like this, we can just bring in the thing that is next in the pattern. And if we're right, there's not going to be a cache miss. Now, if we're wrong, that's not free. We've accessed something from the next level, and we've possibly evicted something to bring it in. Or we might have replaced something because, you know, the cache is probably full once we get started. But fortunately, these sequential access patterns are so often right that that wrong case is usually not a big deal. Because almost all the time when we bring something in based on these sort of nice sequential access patterns, it's going to be correct. It's going to be actually something the program is about to access, and we'll just avoid misses almost all the time. Some questions about prefetching? So I mentioned prefetching sort of as a way we can attack these compulsory misses. And we can also kind of look at our other types of misses as far as like what cache design changes affect them. So this would be helpful if we look at programs and say, oh, we're having lots of conflict misses, then we know we should probably focus on cache size and associativity. If we know we're having a lot of capacity misses, we know we need to do something about cache size somewhere. Like, dealing with other factors is not going to do much. This is another way we might think about caches for choosing optimizations. Questions about our types of misses? Okay, so let's... I guess I should mention, in practice, I mentioned about categorizing misses. In practice, commonly, the way people designing caches will actually do things is they'll run a benchmark and they'll run it in a simulator where they can try a whole different bunch of types of caches and get like the actual measurements. know, this is sort of what people end up doing. Yes, this is not like fast to do, but it's worth doing if you're designing hardware that you can only build with this. And so like here are some benchmarks from around 2000, given when the benchmark was written, and where someone just ran it in a simulator and simulated what would happen with whole different bunch of cache designs as far as the miss rate goes. Yes.
So, like, to fix caching ratios the different way is just to replace the physical cache, right?
The question, to fix capacity misses, the only way is to replace the physical cache. So I would say all the changes we talked about here are likely to require changes to the physical cache. So it's just a question of which changes should you be prioritizing is what you're answering by looking at the types of misses. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so next we're gonna look at relating cache accesses to like actual code we run. So like I told you, we can do this with simulation. We're gonna look at it sort of at a more micro scale and try to get sort of an intuition for how do programs use the cache. We're gonna start out with this function here. And I only care about data cache accesses, so it accesses the instruction cache to read the three instructions. What about the data cache accesses? I'm asking what data cache accesses are there? I have the function in C and the assembly that we assume was generated here. Someone tell me a data cache access. Anyone. This function does. Yeah. This first line accesses scale factor, which is a global variable, and this is a sort of label, which is the same thing as the address of that variable. So it's accessing it from memory. Yeah. So there's one other data cache access. Can someone tell me what it is? Yes. Getting the return address, yes. So something you might be familiar with, given the homework that you have to implement return. So we have the read of scale factor and the read of the return address. So we have two data cache accesses. So let's say this is being used in a loop. And in the loop, every time this is called in a loop, we're gonna have the same return address and the same scale factor address. So this is a great candidate for caching, actually. We hope that these should all be cache hits. If we had, say, a direct map cache with 32 kilobyte blocks, 32 kilobyte cache with 64 byte blocks, so we end up having 6 offset bits and 2 to the 15 over 2 to the 6 sets, which gives us 9 set index bits. We divided up the tag index and offset like so. I'm pretty sure we're confident enough that we would be able to do this with the time and a calculator. I'm not going to have us do it now. And it happens that I chose two plausible looking addresses that happen to have the same index and different tags. So in our direct map cache, these would be conflict misses. Oops. Now, of course, this is kind of a contrived example, but I set them up to have the same index, by choosing exactly the right spot on the stack. But this sort of issue sort of gives us an intuition for why real programs would have problems with direct map cache performance, right? We sometimes have this bad luck situation, and if we happen to have it happen in some nice loop like this, that loop's going to run way, way slower all of a sudden. And we could just solve this problem by having some associativity. We just kind of had some bad luck that we could have avoided if we were really clever in our compiler, but it's not really something that's practical for compilers to do, so in practice we like caches avoiding it by giving us multiple sets, so multiple weights. Now, let's talk about some other examples of thinking about C code and cache access. So we have this example where we figure out, like, look at the assembly, we figure out what are the cache accesses, and we could sort of say, how do they map to tag index offset and simulate what's going to happen that way. Will they conflict? Will they not? And we're going to look at some simple examples, and we're going to think about arrays, because arrays are like the big case where we care about cache performance, because, well, we care about the cache when we're accessing lots of data. And typically that's when we have big arrays. So we're going to deal a lot with arrays in the next class or so. I'm going to start with some very simple examples. So here, this is trying to make this very simple. This is also should remind you of the homework problem, question 3. So here I have a one set, so as simple as I can make it, one set direct map cache. So there's one block in this cache. And the blocks are 8 bytes. Our ints here are 4 bytes. So this array is 16 bytes in total. 4 elements times 4 bytes. And let's assume even sum and odd sum are kept in registers so they don't access the data cache. So only the accesses to the array use the data cache. My question is, how many misses do we expect? And let's also assume that the compiler like actually compiles this in the order I've written. It doesn't try to do anything clever to like order things in a better way or something like that. How many misses do I expect? Check with your neighbor. Would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have one miss? 2 misses. 3 misses. 4 more misses. No clue. Okay, so mostly 2 misses. So 2 seems like a sensible answer, but didn't actually give you enough information. So we want to know, we have these array elements, so we have 4 byte array elements. And I need to know how they map to cache blocks. And those of you who got the answer too probably were assuming it was like this, which is a very sensible assumption. This is what I hope the compiler would end up doing. So that array of 0 would be the beginning of a cache block. And in that case, our array fits neatly into 2 cache blocks, which is the least we can do. And we read in the first cache block that gets us array 0 and 1 with 1 cache miss. We have a hit when we access cache 2, array 1, and we read in array 2, array 3. There's also some writes. I'm just not writing, indicating the writes because the writes always happen after a read, so they're always hits. So I'm not going to include the writes, but the writes are hits. They don't increase the number of misses. So we can see that we have 2 misses. It's probably the scenario you can. But maybe the way the cache blocks works is like this. So in this case, the array fits in 3 cache blocks. We have to read all 3 of them in order to do this code. So we read array of 0. That brings in array of 0 and some stuff before it. We read array of 1. That's a miss that brings in array of 1 and 2. Then we access array of 1 and 2 a bunch. And as I mentioned, including some writes I'm not including on this list. So they're always hits. Then I access array of 3. And I have to bring that in along with the stuff after the array because that's the rest of the block. I have to bring the whole block. Don't have a choice, even though we know we aren't using it. Or the array could be like this. And we'd have to, and we end up having to like read in different parts of it separately. That's something which could also happen. Now, as I mentioned, this first scenario is a lot better. And generally, compilers and also malloc and new implementations are going to try to make sure we're in the first scenario. They won't, that it won't always end up happening. but usually we'll end up in that scenario, and the compiler in Malgnu will try to make that the case more often, because it's a whole lot better. And in particular, they might not avoid this scenario, they'll definitely avoid this scenario almost all the time. This is really annoying. Okay. Let's do a different example. And here, now I have our nice assumption. Array of zeros at the beginning of a cache block, so we're in the good scenario. But I've changed the code a little bit. It shows how many misses do we have now. Same cache. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have two misses? Three, four, five or more? No clue. Okay, so most people said four. That is what I got. So what happens here? We're accessing the same amount of stuff, and we know the whole thing. So, but what happens is we read array zero. That's going to give us 0 and 1. This is going to be array index 0 and 1 in the cache. And that's all the cache can hold. It's one block. And we're going to write to 0. We're not going to write. We're going to read 0. Then we're going to read in 2. That's not 0 or 1. So we're going to bring in 2. That's going to be, so these are both misses. And we're going to bring in 2 and 3, because that's the cache block that contains 2. Then we're going to read in 1. Well, that's not 2 or 3. Yes, we had it in the cache earlier, but too bad, we replaced it with 2 and 3. It's very unfortunate, because that means this has to be a miss. And we're going to bring in 0 and 1, because that's the block that contains 1. And, well, that's unfortunate here, because next we're going to read 3, which we just had in the cache, but we just got rid of it. We're going to bring in 2 and 3, so we have 4 misses. Questions? Yes. Question is, array 0 is the beginning of cache block. How does that affect our first access? So array 0 being at the beginning of the cache block means we're in this scenario. So our cache block that contains array 0 is array 0 and array 1. So that's what we'll end up reading into the cache. But that doesn't help us in this example because that doesn't include array of 2. And when we read in array of 2, we read in that whole cache block, and that still doesn't help us in the next access and so on. Does that answer your question? Oh, okay. Your question, assuming array 0 is already in the cache block? Yeah, so, okay, yes. Beginning of a cache block, yeah, I meant to assume the cache started empty. But if it didn't start empty, we'd indeed have, we'd have three misses. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. So for second instruction, is it possible that like algebra array misses the two bits, like one and two instead of three?
The question, after we miss two, could we fetch one and three?
One, two instead of two.
One and two?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, because remember that the way we divide it up into cache blocks, this is based on how the offset bits work, right? And once we've chosen where the array is, the offset bits work in that way. We can't change, like, the offset bits and the set index bits work in that way. We can't change that at that point, right? So in order to keep one and two together, they'd have to have the same set index and tag bits. And if 0 and 1 have the same set index and tag bits, 1 and 2 can't.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's do a bigger example. So here, we're going to have a two-set cache. So we have two sets. There's still direct maps. We don't have a replacement policy, just only one place to put everything. And beginning of a cache block plus the cache is initially empty. Your lecture more time? Okay, so who thinks we would need two or three misses? Four or five? Okay. Six or seven? Eight or more? Okay, So most people got 4 or 5s. I get 4. So there's a couple of ways we can look at this. So one is I can do sort of my systematic analysis. So let's say our first thing goes to, we have a click cache block. So 0 and 1 go to index 0. And that would mean 2 and 3 go to index 1. Then 4 and 5 go to index 0, and so on. And we can kind of simulate the entire contents of the cache access by access. This would be one way of solving this problem. This seems like it's going to get awfully tedious if we get to anything remotely resembling a realistic cache size. But there's some things we can do to make this analysis simpler. So one observation we can make is everything that happens with set 0, index 0, doesn't affect index 1. That kind of each row works independently. So we can take advantage of this and say, let's only look at our accesses to set 0, and we can look at them independently because everything that happens with the other accesses won't affect set 0. Because once we decide what set we're using, we never look at the other sets. So I can say, to figure out what happens in set 0, I know that the access to 0, 1, and 4, 5, they go there. So I can just say 0 is a miss, that brings in 0 and 1, access 1, that is a hit, and I access 4, and I can look at that independently for set 0. I can do the same thing for set 1 and just add up the two values. And actually, it's easier than that because I can observe that, oh, set 1 just is another example of the same pattern we saw for set 0, so I can just say this is going to be the same because the pattern's exactly the same. And so I can just do the analysis for set 0, realize set 1 is going to be the same. And just multiply by 2 because there's 2 of the same thing. And I guess I should say, in this case, I called the block, the index containing array of 0, set 0. Note that everything would be the same. It was set 1 and the other one was 0, right? It's the same, it just renumbered things. So it didn't actually matter whether the index was really 0 or not. Just that they're two different indices, and I just needed to identify that. So another thing we could have done is I could have said, oh, wait, 0 and 1 are together in a set, 2 and 3 are, sorry, 0 and 1 are together in a block, 2 and 3 are together in a block, and when I access things in the same block, I always access them together. So that's an observation I could have made. So it's never going to matter that I'm accessing a block twice other than immediately after a previous access to it, right? Because I'm always accessing things in a block together. I'm never accessing anything else in between. So I could have just said, we have to read each block in once, then we access it several times and it's a hit. And I could say, well, we have to read in the block containing 0, then I access that a bunch of times, then the block containing 2, I access that a bunch of times. And it doesn't actually matter how many sets my cache has, because I'm only reading in the block the first time, which has to be a miss, and accessing it right afterwards, which is going to be a hit because we just read it in. And I could also use that to figure out we have 4 misses. So questions on any of these ways of working out the number of misses? So let's do another example. So same cache, I've just reordered the code. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we need 4 or 5 misses? 6 or 7? 8 or 9? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on, I think probably 8 is the answer, I bet. So one way I could figure this out is I look at the axes to set 0, and that's 0, 1, and 4, 5 are going to be set 0. And we see we access 0, then 4, so that's going to be a miss, and another miss. And then we access 1. Last thing we accessed was 4. We only have one thing in each set, so that's going to be a miss. We're going to bring in 0 and 1. Then we access 5. Last thing we accessed was 1, not in the same block. It's going to be another miss. So they're all misses. If I do the analysis for set 1, I find the same thing. They're still all misses, so I have 8 misses in total. So one way is writing this out systematically. And you know, I can do it separately for each set, realize both sets work the same way, and say reuse my analysis, or I can just write it all out. Like, some questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so next time, we don't have time to do this, we're gonna generalize this to more realistic sizes of caches and arrays. And we're going to do that a little bit, and then we're going to talk about, well, doing this analysis for real realistic programs is going to be very tedious, so we're going to talk about an approximation that's more practical, and then think about how do we write programs that take advantage of a cache, given this knowledge of how we can approximate the number of misses that will occur.